Lancer Radio Network. LancerRadioNetwork.org.
This is Community College Path. I'm David Nguyen. At CCP, we talk with community college researchers and practitioners to help students navigate community college and transfer. Today, I'll be interviewing Kelly Nielsen, a sociology PhD candidate at UC San Diego. His research article was published in Sociology of Education and is titled, Fake It Till You Make It, Why Community College Students' Aspirations Hold Steady. You're listening to the Lancer Radio Network, Pasadena Campus Sounds, streaming live at LancerRadioNetwork.org. Welcome to the show, Mr. Nielsen. A central concept of your study is how students' college aspirations may change by going to community college. Can you state the range of possible college aspirations community college students can have, and the way aspirations can change?
Community college offers a number of trajectories that people can really aspire to go down, a number of pathways. They can go for very short-term technical certificates in things like many of the participants in my study wanted to go and get a certificate for certified nursing assistant. So you can do these short-term certificates, and then you can go off into the workforce. You can aspire to longer-term certificates in things like cosmetology and do these concurrently along with, say, an associate's degree. So you can aspire for an associate's degree with the intention of going into a sort of a specific field of work. You can simply aspire to an associate's degree in a kind of general education program. You can do an associate's degree with the intention of transferring to a four-year university. So you can aspire to a bachelor's degree and get the associate's degree along the way. Or you can do what I did, which was simply to fulfill the transfer requirements. And I aspired to a bachelor's degree. I didn't complete the requirements for the associate's degree. So there are a number of trajectories you can go down. Now, as far as the way aspirations can change, we could boil it down to kind of three general areas that one can enter into the community college with a goal, for instance, to transfer to a four-year institution, and then over time they decide that they're going to lower their aspiration, that it's more reasonable to do something else or just even more desirable for them. One can enter into the community college and just hold steady, right? Maintain that aspiration over a long period of time despite this limited or very slowed progress. And others, and this was a concern that more recent research on community college found, was that students get to college and they find that their aspirations are being warmed up by the institution, by the people who are in the community college. So they raise their aspirations. So they might come in thinking, well, I just want an associate's degree. But they encounter teachers and counselors and others who say, really, you should go for a bachelor's degree, aim really high. And so they do. They decide that they want more than what they had intentionally come in for. So I think this covers three main sort of areas that aspirations can go in. But if you look over time, it can often be a sort of mix. Aspirations can go up and down, and they can really shift around, and they can change depending on even the sort of conversation that you're having. So over the course of an interview, someone might aspire to one particular degree aspiration, but then as they go along talking, they think, well, actually, I really do want to do this other thing, and hopefully this other thing happens. And so aspirations are often very fluid.
To illustrate the concept of cooling out, would the following experience be an example? When I was in high school, my English teacher asked me what I wanted to do after I graduated. At the time, I wanted to become a dermatologist, and I told her that. She laughed and she said, you know you had to go to college to do that, right? And she suggested that I consider going into beauty school instead. Would that be an example of cooling out?
Absolutely. And I think the secondary level, the high school level, there are maybe a different set of processes. And we haven't, at least the sociology of education, hasn't really applied that language of cooling out to the high school setting to the same extent that it has in the community college. But that's exactly the process that Burton Clark, who in the 1960s coined this term cooling out, that community colleges did this aspiration management where they, in the interaction between students and teachers, they do this sort of gentle discouragement like you describe, and in the process, students decide to change their goals from something that might require more education to something that would require less. So I think that very much does describe a cooling out process, though we should really be careful to distinguish between what happens in the high school setting, because that's a very different type of environment than the community college. And so it's important to think about how they differ, but what you're getting at is that essential aspiration management towards the end of cooling out.
Now that we understand how college aspirations may cool out, hold steady, or warm up, can you tell us your research questions?
Yeah, so my research questions were to ask why community college students who were really making little or no progress towards their degree aspirations over a long period of time were doing what scholars call holding steady. So I wanted to ask, why do community college students hold steady? And the second question I wanted to ask was, how do community college students hold steady? So for me, it was really an interesting question of why this was a reasonable thing to do and why it was plausible, why it was believable to themselves and others that despite this very slow progress, they would be able to tell themselves and tell others that they were still pursuing their academic aspirations. So I wanted to know, how do community college students hold steady? And then I think the final research question, which I'm not really able to get into as much with this particular group of students that I studied, but really is what happens when you're no longer able to hold steady? What might some of those consequences be? And so I really try to think through the consequences of that limit where holding steady is no longer reasonable or plausible for many students.
That's interesting, because you would think that if a community college student was coming in year after year after year and making little progress, that they would eventually give up or lower their aspirations.
Absolutely. And this was really what sociologists and scholars of higher education really expected to happen. They looked at students who came in large numbers, really aspiring to degrees, particularly bachelor's degrees, and they saw that these students were not transferring at very high rates. So there was a huge discrepancy, a huge gap between aspirations for college degrees and attainment of college degrees. And a lot of these students ended up eventually leaving or pursuing maybe something more shorter term, like a certificate in a sort of technical field. So they assumed that they had abandoned their goals, that they had simply given them up. And really, we find that they didn't. That wasn't, or maybe it was a good assumption at the time, but today it's no longer sort of an assumption that we could hold on to.
Can you elaborate on how low completion rates may not necessarily be linked with lowered aspirations?
As I mentioned, the early research really assumed a lot about what students were doing in terms of aspirations. So they didn't necessarily go and ask the students themselves, and if they did, they certainly didn't do it over time to really track whether aspirations were going down or conversely if they were going up. More recently, research has started to measure student aspirations over time, and there are two particular cases within the sociology of education. James Rosenbaum and his colleagues, they tracked student aspirations over a five-year period, and they found that, in fact, students didn't lower their aspirations over this time at a rate of nearly 70%. And this included students who may have left college altogether. On the other hand, there was a study by Carl Alexander and his colleagues that looked at tracked students' aspirations in Baltimore over a very long period. They started very early in school children's lives. And they found that amongst those 12th grade high school seniors that had an aspiration for a bachelor's degree in 12th grade, by the age of 22, nearly 60% still wanted that bachelor's degree. And by the age of 28, a quarter of them still wanted that bachelor's degree. And again, this is regardless of whether they were in school or out of school. certainly their sort of enrollment in community college made some difference, but people across the spectrum of college experience still held on to their aspirations. So this research really called into question this assumption that people were lowering their aspirations if they left or if they, you know, really struggled in school. So this led us to say, well, what's going on in their lives? What, how do they explain this holding steady? So we know quantitatively with survey data that this is happening, but we didn't know exactly why it was happening. So it was sort of up to us to go and ask students why they were holding on to their aspirations for such long periods of time.
As you mentioned, although early theories of cooling out may have applied to community colleges of the 1960s, they no longer apply to our current community colleges. So what are the changes from the community college of the 1960s and the community college as we know it now?
There are changes both within the community college and outside of the community college. You know, since the 1960s, the idea of college for all has really taken hold. And this is the idea that everyone can and should go to college and get a college degree, particularly a four-year degree. Now, Burton Clark noticed in the 1950s and 1960s, as the community college was really booming, that there was this social expectation that more and more people would get higher degrees. There was a kind of economic demand for more highly educated workers. But this has become a much greater feature, I think, of today's social world that students are making decisions in. So the ideology of college for all has really spread quite widely so that the vast majority of young adults want to get a college education. And there's this idea that a college degree is absolutely necessary for the high wage, high skilled jobs that are increasingly replacing more blue collar and technical jobs. So there's this stronger pull from the sort of broader culture of higher education, this idea that people should be getting college educated. And there's a stronger push from the economic forces that are sort of making the work available to people without at least some college much less desirable, and the jobs that are available to college graduates much, much more worthy of pursuing. So there are these large changes. Now, within the college itself, James Rosenbaum, again, and his colleagues, they really found that colleges had embraced this college for all ideology. They had turned the processes that Clark identified as cooling people out into processes that actually warmed people's aspirations up. So when they would go, say, and take a remedial math class, well, in the past, remediation, the classes that are used to help students get up to college-level work, these classes, Clark argued, were really discouraging. They were meant to sort of give people a sense they weren't college material. Well, today, remediation is done in a way that, according to James Rosenbaum and others, that really is meant to encourage students to continue trying. So even in the courses that are trying to just help people get up to college level, they're also pushing higher college aspirations. Counselors are pushing college students to go on and transfer. Teachers are pushing students to go on and transfer. So that idea that community colleges somehow select the students that should maybe do something other than try to get a four-year degree has really seems to have disappeared. So that community colleges are really embracing the college for all ideology. And I think this is part of a broader trend towards what the sociologist of education, David Baker, calls the schooled society. This is the idea that colleges really generate the kinds of values and ideals that society holds on to. So to really fully belong or participate in mainstream society, a college degree is becoming increasingly necessary. So this is real difference from the time when you could sort of lower your aspirations and maybe go in a direction that would still provide you a very high quality of life, but not necessarily a college degree.
What methods did you use to answer how and why community college students hold steady?
So to answer our research questions, we used a method called longitudinal qualitative interviewing. So all this means is that we engaged in interviews with a number of students over time. We did 4 interviews, me and 3 other researchers, to track students' aspirations and the way that they thought about their experiences in community college. And so this is really important because, on the one hand, to understand whether people are actually holding steady, you have to track their aspirations over time. But to be able to understand why they do it, and really that sort of complicated sense-making that people engage in to hold steady, you really have to use these qualitative methods, methods that aren't just using survey and statistical analysis, but rather are engaged in sort of long periods of talk and observation.
For your study, you interviewed poor and minority women only. Why is that?
Well, this was part of a much larger project that was called the Pathways to Post-Secondary Success Project, and this project was funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to look at a sort of broad range of experiences for poor community college students, because the Gates Foundation's interest is very much in reducing poverty and using education as a way to achieve this goal. And the community college is where the vast majority of traditionally excluded populations of students, poor students, students of color, enter into the higher education system. Now, for this particular study, we decided to focus on women because, and especially poor women and many of those women with children, because when we looked at the rates of attainment, we saw that this was the group that was most likely to have to leave college for a variety of reasons, whether it be childcare or work or other roles that they have to fill in their lives. So we wanted to really look at that group of students who are facing the greatest obstacles to finish and try to identify from that sort of most extreme level of difficulty what were the barriers that were really critical for them. So we wanted to look at that particular group. And also because for women college students, the returns to college education often come much later in the education attainment process. So for poor and working class men, there's often a greater return in the labor market. So in terms of getting jobs, in terms of getting higher pay at the jobs that you have, in terms of job stability, those things go up with less college. So if you get some college, you'll see some return often for poor and working class men. For women, it comes much later. So it comes much more towards the bachelor's degree, where you begin to start to see those types of returns. And so for us, it was really important because they had really the most to lose if they give up early on. So holding steady for them seems to be a real necessary thing in terms of those basic attainments of jobs and wages and stability.
Measuring aspirations over time seems difficult enough. But on top of that, you're a white man with an advanced degree interviewing poor and minority women. How did you plan on getting these women to open up to you?
There were two main ways, I think, that I was able to generate some rapport and trust in the process. One is that I was also a community college student. I went to community college over the course of 10 years myself. So I had held steady. I had done very poorly in classes early on in my community college career. And so I had faced many of the same academic struggles, at the very least, that some of the participants that I interviewed were facing. So I was able to sort of share that common experience. Many of the women in the study had small children while they were in college, and I, too, at least in graduate school, had small children, still do. And so that was another point at which we could find some common ground to really talk about the challenges. And granted, their challenges with raising small children while going to college were often much greater than the ones that I faced, but we were at least able to find some points of commonality. And then the sort of longitudinal nature of the study, the fact that we interviewed 4 different times over the course of nearly 4 years, was really important for generating some kind of relationship. It allowed them to get more confident and more comfortable over the interview. And in many cases, I was one of the first people to really sit down and ask the kinds of questions that I was asking about what their dreams were, what they wanted from their education and from life more generally, what the challenges that they had were. And so for them, it was often extremely valuable to be able to sit down with someone and share these things, particularly as they got to know me over time. Certainly in that first interview, someone might have been much more reluctant to share some of the information that I was asking. But by the fourth interview, nearly 3.5 years later, people were often much more comfortable and much more willing to open up and much more sort of happy for themselves for the opportunity to do it.
I'm glad to hear that they enjoyed the interviewing process. Now, can you give us an overview of the women's aspirations over time?
Over time, over 3/4 of the women said they planned to transfer to a 4-year university in the very beginning. So that's 18 of the women wanted to transfer and get a bachelor's degree during the first interview. And 5 planned on earning an associate's degree. Now, by the final interview, there were 7 had transferred, the 23 total women that participated in the study. And so that's about 28%, and that's pretty consistent with the transfer rate of the community college district. I think nationally, the transfer rate over a 6-year period is about 33%. So 28% was sort of close to that. So 7 had transferred, and there were 16 women who did not transfer, and 9 still planned on transferring. 4 planned for less than a bachelor's degree, so they just wanted to get an associate's degree or a certificate of some sort. And then 3 had no further plans for higher education at this time. So of these 3, 2 had accomplished their goal of getting an associate's degree and they left. So 1 student got an associate's degree in drug and alcohol counseling, and she went to be a drug and alcohol counselor. Now, she still expected one day to kind of go back and get a bachelor's degree, hopefully, and possibly even a master's, but she was in a place where she was working and developing her career. Another got an associate's degree, and she left school to work. She went to do film and makeup in Hollywood, and she was pursuing her career. And even though that didn't quite work out the way she wanted it to, she had no intention of going back for a bachelor's degree the last time I met her. And then 1 woman abandoned her goals entirely. She started college, and she wanted a bachelor's degree in nursing. But by the 4th interview, she had left and was not interested in finishing any kind of certificate or other type of degree. So she was completely done. So that is the sample. That's the group of women.
To remind our listeners, your study sought to answer why and how students hold steady, despite obstacles. From your interviews, you found 2 narratives students would use to hold steady. The first was pragmatic job-seeking behavior, and the second was moral self-improvement reasons. Can you discuss what pragmatic reasons are?
Yeah, the pragmatic reasons are really those reasons that are aimed at meeting the basic economic requirements of their life. So getting a well-paying job, getting a job that is stable, getting a job that has regular hours, getting a job that will then help them to get the basic necessities of middle-class life. So the ability to buy a home, to support their children and take care of them in a way that they're comfortable with, and then possibly one day giving them the chance to travel. So this is the kind of narrative that links college degrees to economic outcomes. And that was very common across the sample. Everyone recognizes that college degrees are crucial for one's success in the workforce. And then as a result, their ability to just broadly participate in middle-class life.
To illustrate pragmatic narratives, can you share Amy's experience with us?
Amy was a young woman who early on, she wanted to work as an esthetician, but she wanted to be able to do things like Botox and laser treatments. And so she took a high school ROP program, these programs that allow high school students to start to develop skills and get certificates in particular trades. And so she pursued this career in esthetician beauty and other more surgical aspects. And she realized that she was going to have to get a nursing degree to do this. So she went to community college to get the nursing degree so she could do these more invasive beauty treatments. And over time, she realized that she was having a hard time finding work on the one hand because she was very young. She thought people simply didn't want a very young person doing this kind of work on them. And the other is that she had a Latina background, and she thought that there could possibly be people who are simply discriminating against her as she tried to do this work. So she eventually, she sort of held on to this goal of doing this work, but in the process she started working in different nursing care facilities, doing medical records management and other things. And this supported her. She went to school and she sort of tried to figure out how she would use school to get her into a stronger financial position, possibly working in the medical records field. But she got laid off and she was unemployed for about 2 years. And this really impacted her ability to go to college. And so, you know, when I met her at the time that she was unemployed, she really understood that college was an absolute necessity to find work. She felt that every job she was trying to apply for, she simply wasn't being given a chance because she didn't have even an associate's degree. She thought the associate's degree was absolutely critical. So she realized that she wasn't going to get anywhere or be able to do any of the things that she wanted to do if she wasn't able to finish school. And of course, being unemployed and having small children made that extremely difficult to do. So she found herself kind of in a trap, and she really did feel trapped at a certain point. So this sort of gnawing necessity of college to get ahead, and then this inability to really actually put the time and effort and resources into college was a real challenge for her.
The second narrative you found that students used to hold steady was moral self-improvement narratives, which you broke down into four themes. 1, claims for virtue. 2, boundary making. 3, challenging stereotypes. And 4, attempts to manage relationships. Can you elaborate on claims for virtue?
Yeah, claims for virtue are claims that link one's own self, one's own life to what would be socially recognized as being a good person by using college. So oftentimes this would mean aspiring to a college degree just for the sake of college. So saying, I'm a good person because I am trying to go to college. And oftentimes they would do this by aspiring to more education than they would possibly need. So in many cases, the job that they would want would only require a bachelor's degree. And they often knew this. But they say, anyway, I want a master's degree, or I want a PhD anyway. And it often didn't matter what the degree was in. It was just a display of ambition. And part of my argument is that being ambitious is virtuous, that it is something that is socially valued. And so simply by making their aspirations more ambitious than they need to be in terms of economic outcomes, they are making a show of virtue.
Adele's experience is a great example of claims for virtue. Can you tell us about her experience?
Absolutely. So Adele, she enrolled in community college when she was 19 because she had watched a behind-the-scenes making of a music video that she really loved. And she wanted to work in film and television. She went into the film and television program. She did extremely well in her film and television classes. And she even sacrificed some of her work in her general education courses because she was so involved in the film and television program. This is where, you know, she made all her friends. She thought of them like a family and had many successes. They made a student film that won an award. She worked on a reality TV show that had been aired in the program and different broadcasts around the area. And so she was very successful in film and television. And she really felt like when she was ready, she could get a job in the industry because she had developed a network of people that she could rely on to help her get a job. And she understood that Hollywood operated on this system of networks, that jobs were gotten through who you know, not necessarily what you know or what kind of credentials that you might have from school. So she was really well-placed, and she actually thought that getting a bachelor's degree would hurt her chances because it would just slow her down, that people don't necessarily want someone who's been trained in college. They want someone who's been out working in the field. But she wanted a bachelor's degree anyway, and she knew all this. But she said, you know, it would really kill me if I couldn't be an educated person. And so she was going to pursue a bachelor's degree no matter what. And you know, she had a lot of obstacles to overcome. She had failed a number of the required courses for transfers, especially ones like math, which are really challenging for some students to get over. This can often be a major stumbling block on the way to transfer. So she had these classes. She had several more to do to fill the requirements for transfer that she had just put off, and she was starting to feel quite bad about the fact that it was taking her so long to get through college. Despite all the great experience and skills that she had developed, she thought she should have been done at that point and transferred and working towards the bachelor's degree. So I think hers is a great case where this idea of the educated person and the desire to get a bachelor's degree simply for the sake of getting a bachelor's degree is really evident, that this is something that allows her to feel like a virtuous member of society, even when it is potentially costing her in the career that she had chosen for herself. And it was certainly already costing her in terms of the money that she wasn't making by staying in school and not getting a job. So I think hers is a really terrific example of the power of that need to be both ambitious and to do it through higher education.
The second theme of moral self-improvement was drawing boundaries through their education. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, boundaries are, they're a way of creating a self-identity by distancing or identifying others who are different from oneself. So creating in-groups, groups that you belong to and that reflect your identity in some way, and then out-groups, those groups that you do not belong to and that do not belong in your group because they are somehow different. And in this case, higher education was used, and this idea of the educated person, someone who is willing to do the hard work, to not give up, to continue pushing and striving for a college degree despite the obstacles, really was used to distinguish them from all those other people who were too lazy or not strong enough to go through the process. So by looking at others and saying, well, we might be in a similar social position or a similar set of circumstances, but really we're different. I'm not like you. I don't have those negative qualities. I have these positive qualities, qualities that are going to be recognized because I am holding on to my dream of college. Maybe I'm still going, maybe I'm not going, but I still believe that I will do it someday. And this is what distinguishes me from you. And this is the sort of way of, you know, really shoring up one's identity in the face of really difficult challenges, but also elevating oneself in the process.
To illustrate your point, can you share how Margaret used education to draw boundaries?
Margaret was a poor woman. She recognized and described the situation that her and her family were in very clearly. She lived with her mom and her grandmother and her uncle and her daughter all in the same house. None of them worked, and they used different kinds of social supports to get by. And Margaret knew that it was sort of a problem to be a poor and unemployed single mom. I mean, she saw this as a stigmatized figure in society, someone who's, you know, looked down upon or viewed negatively. And she really wanted to distance herself from that. And the one way she did it was by going to college. She had a hard time finding a job, even though she knew she should work. She applied and applied and applied and couldn't get any calls back. And she went to college as a way of really generating a sense of self-worth. I mean, she felt when she wasn't in school, she felt very useless. And this is despite the fact that she was going and volunteering in her daughter's classroom. I mean, she was very involved in her daughter's life. She really saw herself as a very good mother, but it wasn't enough without being able to go to college. And what really drove this home was that she had finished the associate's degree and the transfer requirements to go to a four-year university, but she said she lacked the self-esteem to transfer. She didn't feel like she would survive in the large university environment, and so she didn't transfer. But she kept going to community college. She kept taking classes just to be connected to the school, and she really saw this as a way of expressing her morality. And so she said, look, I'm not one of these crack addict or I'm not a prostitute. I mean, she used these images of really negative stereotypes and said, I'm not that because I'm going to school. She didn't say, I'm not that because I volunteer in my daughter's daycare or my daughter's school. It was really using college as a way to distinguish between herself and poor people that have this very negative image of drug abuse and other sort of character flaws.
The third theme of moral self-improvement was challenging stereotypes. How does education challenge stereotypes?
This is similar to boundaries in that there is this negative image that people are dealing with, these ways that poor people and poor students of color, poor women of color are popularly described. They're using these, but they're not applying them to other people to say, oh, they're like that, but I'm not. They're saying, I am going to college to prove that this stereotype is not true, or to prove that there are people who are not like this, that when people look at me, if they have this stereotype, that they're wrong because I am a college student. It's a way of really demonstrating to others that they don't belong to these particular categories. And now, in some cases, they don't necessarily say, well, this category shouldn't exist at all. I mean, there's still a chance that they can do boundary work. It's very slippery, but it's important to recognize that one can challenge stereotypes without having to put somebody else down in the process. But in some cases, they can move between these two ways of making boundaries and sort of using the stereotypes to distance themselves and then rejecting the stereotype for themselves. And I think it's an important, it's a subtle distinction, but it's an important one.
Can you share one of the women's experiences of challenging stereotypes?
Kimberly's story, I think, is important for challenging stereotypes because Kimberly really believed that, you know, her education would be the only thing that people would look at, even in a society that was still very much racist, very discriminatory against young people of color. She even talked about this discrimination that was occurring in the world around her. She looked at her neighborhood, for instance, and she saw really aggressive policing against young men and women of color. And she acknowledged that in the labor market, there are people who make very discriminatory judgments when they are choosing to hire someone. She saw this happening no matter who was doing the hiring, that there was this chance that you would encounter someone who would be discriminatory. But in her mind, she really believed that her education and her hard work would overcome any of that discrimination when she was trying to find work. She sort of saw what economists might call a signal that can be heard really through all this noisiness of discrimination that's complicating decision-making. She said this would really be a signal that would say, look, I've worked hard. Your stereotypes that are causing you to discriminate against me, that they don't mean anything because I've gone to college, I've done the hard work, I've got a degree to prove it. And she really felt like this would accomplish that for her.
The fourth theme of moral self-improvement narratives was managing relationships. How does a college education manage relationships?
Managing relationships is really about having the ability to have a say in your relationships with others. So for the women in the study, college was, at least they believed that college was a way that they could take some control in their relationships with others. And this is, you know, most often family members, but it can include friends. For instance, someone had a difficult friendship and it was getting in the way of their ability to do well in school. They could use college as a way to say, I'm going to take myself out of this relationship, or I'm going to put limits on this relationship because school is so important. In the case of families, for instance, partnerships, marriages, these types of things, college could be a way to say, look, we're going to make decisions around where we live. We're going to make decisions around maybe having children, maybe make decisions around when we decide to get married based on a college timeline. So college could be used as a way to really control what goes on in a family unit or within a peer group or, you know, in a number of different relationships. It just happened that in this particular study, family and peers were so crucial. Now, we weren't able to observe what was going on within these relationships. These interviews were one-on-one, they were done in private, and so it was not something that we could see happening, whether they were doing this kind of management. So what we can say is that they felt like their education gave them a particular say in their relationships with others. It allowed them to say, look, I'm on equal footing in this relationship, or I get a say in this relationship. And, you know, whether they did or did not is something that we would have to go back and learn more about. But college really was used, at least in the stories they told about their relationships, as this important thing that was really managing what that relationship looked like to them.
Can you give an example of how one of the women managed relationships through her education?
I believe it was Carolyn. She had a long-term partner, a daughter, and Carolyn, she wanted to get married, and her partner had plans to get married, but she at least told us that she was delaying getting married precisely because she had to finish more of her education first, that trying to get married would somehow interrupt the process. So for them, and this is important, I think, because the idea of the nuclear family, of the married parents and the children, is a strong kind of moral image. The idea of unmarried couples or single parents is problematic, and for her it was important that despite that they finish more education as opposed to changing their family structure. She also wanted to take a much less intensive role as a mother. So the mother role is also a very morally loaded position. It's something that carries a lot of moral weight in society, and she wanted to do less of it. She wanted to be less attached to the figure of just being a mom. And so for her, it was really important. She said, I didn't want to be just one of those moms on TV that you see all they do is take care of their kid. I wanted to be a good mom, but I also wanted to go to college. So this is really important because she's able to use college because it is also a sort of morally loaded thing to do, that she was able to use it to really reduce that role that she had to play as a mom in her family. So she was negotiating, or at least she believed she was managing these relationships between both her partner who wanted to get married and her daughter who, you know, she was spending all of her time taking care of, to gain some control over those relationships.
What are the benefits and drawbacks of students who hold steady for long periods of time?
So there are a number of possible drawbacks from holding steady. It's costly for students. Some might say that they're taking a long time, they're using college resources, they're not out in the labor market, that they're really delaying their social mobility. So people who might be really concerned about college as a source of social mobility, that it's being delayed or being reduced as they just stay in college as opposed to getting into the workforce. That's one problem. There's also the potential problem that when you elevate college to such a social necessity, you know, you make it so important for everybody to be doing that when people really fall short of being able to do it, that it can really lead to a kind of isolating experience. And this is something that sociologists like Jennifer Silva has been starting to look at, that, you know, when people can't make the socially necessary transitions to adulthood, that they really do tend to withdraw inward and become more hostile to the world around them. So by making college tremendously important, students just not transitioning towards other things that might give them a source of validation can be potentially damaging to their sense of self. And then, of course, some of the problems are creating boundaries between themselves and other people who are in very similar positions but who are possibly just making different decisions about what to do can be sort of damaging to particular communities as people elevate themselves and put down others. So those are some of the problems, but I think some of the benefits to holding steady, certainly, you know, they do have a wide range of social returns. So higher incomes, improved health outcomes, reduced rates of involvement with the criminal justice system. And so these things are socially beneficial, and for people who are primarily concerned with sort of costs and benefits, these are direct ways that maybe costs to society of holding steady and staying in school can come down. Empowering students to challenge stereotypes is valuable regardless of whatever the outcome is. If a student can challenge these negative views of them and other people like them, this is, I think, an overwhelmingly positive thing. And holding steady, it may not produce the kind of economic quality that a lot of arguments for college hold as this reason that everyone should go to school, but it will allow them to attain a bit of moral equality, to say, I am doing exactly what is expected of me. I am trying to go to college, and everybody demands that I go to college, and I'm out here doing it. And even if I'm struggling to do it, I'm still committed to doing it. And that's a moral claim and a moral equality that I think is entirely necessary in a society that makes higher education so critical.
People usually view persistence as a good quality, but in the context of community college students who attend year after year and make little progress, people could view these students as foolish. So, is it foolish for students to hold steady?
I don't see it as foolish at all. I mean, there are going to be instances. I mean, Adele's case is a very good one where she is putting off certain opportunities to go to work and possibly have a very successful career. And that there might be downsides to that, and that would be a discussion really worth having. But because college is central to the good life in America today, I think that there's absolutely nothing foolish about persisting in participating in that claim to the good life. There's nothing that would be wrong about wanting to do that. And moreover, for many students, leaving college doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to have opportunities elsewhere. This is, I think, a really crucial point where the opportunities that they have for work and the kinds of work that they get to do are really not the kinds of work where they can either support themselves in a way that they desire, nor can they attain the kind of validation and self-worth that work ideally should provide us with. And so there's nothing foolish about holding steady when your sort of alternatives are not going to provide you either the economic benefits or the social value that you need.
Deciding whether or not to hold steady or lower your aspirations to a vocational degree or even drop out entirely seems like a tough decision. What are some things students should consider when making this choice?
It's a very difficult decision, and I think in many cases, students don't have much decision. I think a lot of students get pushed out of college or pushed in certain directions by other forces, for especially poor and working class students. Money, childcare, time are just such scarce resources that they often leave college regardless.
What can be done to better support these students?
They definitely need more resources to go to college, and financial supports are obviously crucial. Time supports with things like childcare, these are essential so that they're not having to hold steady for such long periods of time simply because they're not able to complete the courses or do as well as they need to do in them. I think a part of the reason that students have to hold steady is because it's difficult financially and materially and all these different ways to get through college. So that's crucial. Now, but with the resources people have, I think counseling is a real crucial part of what goes on in their lives when it works well. So a lot of students have very few interactions with counselors. They can be very short. They can often give them just a little bit of guidance, and then they expect them to go on their way and be successful. Or students don't push counseling in the directions they need it because they don't necessarily know. Now, there are students who do get through different programs, like the Educational Opportunities Programs and Services, EOPS, through the welfare program, at least in the California community college system. They often get specialized counseling if you're entering college through the welfare system. And these often provide a very important source of extended counseling. They're usually longer sessions. They're more frequent. and the relationships are much more personal. And this can also happen with a good teacher who takes the time to get to know you, but students often want to be known and want people to do what I did, basically, which is to ask them what their goals are and why they have their goals and what they're hoping to get out of college in a broader sense. And so I think being able to support them is giving them the opportunities to be known by somebody in the system. And these kinds of institutional actor relationships with students, I think, are really critical to helping students persist and knowing that college has this important moral quality, I think is really important, because students may get frustrated if a counselor is saying, well, maybe you should try this career path or that career path, without necessarily recognizing that they're in school for reasons other than just job seeking. So I think it's very difficult to structure these relationships between institutional figures like teachers and counselors and students. But I think there's an important point that when those relationships are formed and they do work well, it can be really important in getting students beyond just holding steady to greater completion.
Thank you so much, Mr. Nielsen, for joining us on Community College Path. Kelly Nielsen is a sociology PhD candidate at UC San Diego. His research article is published in Sociology of Education and is titled Fake It Till You Make It: Why Community College Students' Aspirations Hold Steady. This was Community College Path with your host, David Nguyen. You're listening to Lancer Radio Network, Pasadena Campus Sounds, streaming live at LancerRadioNetwork.org.